From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This month, conductor Michael Tilsa Thomas took over as music director of the San Francisco Symphony. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Tilsa Thomas about his life and career. He was mentored by Leonard Bernstein, fascinated by James Brown's rhythm, and steeped in the Yiddish theater of his grandparents, Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski. Also, helping cops deal with stress after traumatic incidents. We talk with San Antonio police officer Roger Mangum. He co-founded a support group for police officers several years after he shot and killed a man in self-defense in the line of duty. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a reissue by the late mezzo-soprano Kathy Berberian. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the hard part is still to come in Bosnia. He told NBC Today there's a chance for a ceasefire now that there's agreement on the shape of a future Bosnian government. It's a complicated formula, but one Christopher says will succeed.
Well, I think it's the way it has to work. I believe the parties can get along with that. There are a lot of mechanisms built in. There's a lot of connective tissue. Although there are two entities there, there's a presidency, there's a cabinet, there's a constitutional court, there's a parliament. So there's a lot of things holding it together. And this really gives an opportunity for Bosnia to function as a single country.
Still to be resolved is whether Bosnia will have a strong central government, as the Muslims want, or a weak one, as the Serbs prefer. The subject of Bosnia came up today in a 20-minute phone call between President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin. A spokesman said President Clinton stressed the importance of Russian cooperation in finding a Bosnian peace. The two men also agreed to meet next month in Hyde Park, New York, for an abbreviated summit. Defense Secretary William Perry announced today a series of steps to prevent American soldiers from committing crimes overseas. Perry said he was deeply distressed by the rape of a 12-year-old girl in Okinawa, allegedly by American soldiers. Perry spoke in New York at the signing of a new military alliance with Japan. Japan agreed to increase to $5 billion a year its part of the cost of stationing U.S. troops on Japanese soil. Some members of the United Nations are appealing to the U.S. and other debtors to pay their U.N. dues. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The foreign ministers of several key European countries, as well as Canada, have criticized the U.S., either directly or indirectly. They point out that technically the world body is now bankrupt. The biggest delinquent is the U.S., which the U.N. says owes about $1.6 billion, both for the world body's general budget and for peacekeeping operations. During a speech, British Foreign Secretary Malcolm Rifkind proposed a penalty for delinquency, including charging interest on late payments. Diplomats are particularly concerned over Washington's decision to unilaterally decrease its share of peacekeeping expenses from 31% to 25%. Britain and Sweden are proposing that should any country, including the U.S., exceed certain limits of debt on peacekeeping, then they would automatically lose the right to vote in the General Assembly. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Talks between congressional Republicans and the White House have hit a few snags, but an agreement is still expected to keep the government in business past this weekend's deadline. The agreement would allow spending for 6 weeks while the two sides work out their differences. On Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 34.68 points at 4730.92 in heavy trading of 328 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down 20.75 at 1017.30. This is National Public Radio News. The prosecutors have concluded their closing arguments in the double murder trial of O.J. Simpson. They'll have another chance after the defense speaks. In today's session, prosecutor Christopher Darden said Simpson was an angry, jealous, controlling man who killed his former wife and a friend in a rage. More than 5,000 motorists have complained to federal highway safety investigators that the anti-lock brakes on their General Motors vehicles have malfunctioned. Hundreds of accidents have been reported, but no fatalities. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The accidents resulted in more than 430 injuries. Hundreds of drivers have told the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that the anti-lock brakes on their GM vehicles failed to work properly and the vehicle didn't stop in time. Last June, the safety agency opened a preliminary inquiry into the anti-lock brakes on Chevy S10 pickups, Chevy Blazer Sport Utility Vehicles, GMC S15 or Sonoma pickups, GMC Jimny and Oldsmobile Bravada Sport Utility Vehicles built for the model years 1991 through 1994. About 4 months later, the probe was upgraded, and since then, about 1,000 more motorists have filed complaints. A GM spokesman says they believe the braking system is good and the investigation will bear that out. Many motorists who learned to drive using conventional brakes were taught to pump brakes to stop quickly without skidding. With the anti-lock braking system, brake pumping is no longer necessary. The Highway Traffic Safety Administration is studying the braking system to see if any parts are defective. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A new tropical storm is gaining strength in the Atlantic. It's now located about 13 miles east of the Lesser Antilles and is working northwest. Its top sustained winds are 40 miles an hour. It's expected to grow stronger. Its name is Noel. This is only the second time in history that the Atlantic hurricane season has made it to the letter N. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, Michael Tilson Thomas became the music director of the San Francisco Symphony. He's also principal guest conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra and artistic director of the New World Symphony, a Florida-based orchestra of young musicians. At the age of 50, Tilson Thomas's career as a wunderkind is behind him. He was only 24 when he first conducted the Boston Symphony Orchestra, filling in mid-concert for the ailing conductor. He was later appointed principal guest conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He was music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic from 1971 to 79. He discusses his life in music in the new book, Michael Tilson Thomas, Viva Voce. I asked him about the best and worst parts of taking over an orchestra.
The best part of it is the excitement of working with a whole new ensemble of talented people and getting to understand their personalities and really getting to understand how one can work with them and collaborate with them. The excitement of discovering people who have their own original take on things and realizing that in combination with what you have to offer, some kind of new synthesis will indeed result, and that'll get over the footlights and be thrilling for us and thrilling for those who listen to us. And I think the hardest part about it is that really taking over a major American orchestra as music director is somewhat like becoming the new head of General Motors, or it's an enormously daunting process. There, it's a huge organization, and it's difficult to get a grasp of just what all of its activities may be and how one can, you know, best influence and direct these things.
When you were learning stick technique in and you were younger, did you think that being a conductor would also mean, you know, fundraising and administrative work and salary decisions and all that stuff?
No, I didn't really think about that. I mean, I certainly knew from the very beginning that music, even classical music, is a very spiritual and very elevated form of show business, and that show business involves always capturing one's audience imagination, and that to a certain extent, the more one assumes responsibility for the details of production and support of the show, one has greater and greater control of what the final artistic product will be.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned show business, because I want to talk with you a little bit about your background.
Sure.
Your grandparents were stars of the Yiddish theater, Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski. And I think your grandfather died just a few years before you were born.
Correct.
In, 38 or 39?
Right.
And you say, what, 30,000 people attended his funeral?
That's correct.
That's extraordinary.
I found that. I never realized that until just recently. I found the old New York Times piece on his funeral, and there were the pictures of Second Avenue closed off totally in this huge parade of people going out to the cemetery in Brooklyn where he was buried.
What did it make you think about when you found that out?
Well, he was such a larger-than-life character. I mean, in Jewish households, it was always kind of a thing people would say when a child was particularly outrageous or loud or carrying on in some way. They'd say, don't do me a Tomaszewski, because he had a reputation for being, you know, a larger-than-life actor on stage who did melodramatic parts and romances and things like this. And, of course, he had a tremendous reputation also as a Don Juan of Second Avenue. But he also was an enormously courageous man in bringing hundreds, perhaps thousands of people over from the old country and in supporting all kinds of theater, Shakespearean theater, but also the first performances in the United States of Chekhov, Ibsen, Strindberg, Hauptmann, Andreev, very avant-garde things. Shows as well that were the prototypes of what the American musical ultimately became. He was a guy who could do, he could play Hamlet, but he could also do musical comedy, and he could, melodrama. He could do it all, and that was somewhat confusing to later biographers. There's still a definitive text to be done on him, or indeed on the whole meaning of what the Yiddish theater is in the history of American society.
Did you grow up thinking that you literally had show business in your blood?
Oh, I absolutely knew that, especially because I grew up around my grandmother, Bessie Tomaszewski, Boris's wife, who some people say was a greater star than even he. She was a tremendous actress, a natural talent. She had gone on the stage for the first time when she was about 13 and a half years old. And she became a huge headline, first as a tragic actress, and then in her mid-40s, she converted her career into being a major comedian. And she created a number of characters on the stage, one very famous one, Minka the Dienstmoint, Minka the Housemaid, which was a kind of Yiddish kite Pygmalion story. And in this play and others, she created that character that Fanny Brice and Molly Picon and even Barbara Streisand are still playing to this day, that kind of wry, wise, Americanized Jewish woman who has lots of personality and lots of mischief behind their enormous wisdom.
So did she teach you anything about singing or acting when you were growing up?
Well, lots of things. I mean, she told me the history of the theater in enormous detail, and she recited scenes from it. And when I was a very young kid, she took me onto the stage of the Pasadena Playhouse, and we were standing on the stage, and she said, I must have been 3 or 4 at this time, she said, "Look up, Michala, look up, and look up. What do you see far, far away?" And I said, "Well, I see lights." And she said, "Look further up." And she said, "Far way up there, you see that light up there? It says exit." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's very far away." She said, "Well, up there, that's the second balcony or the gallery. And up there are the cheapest seats. And in those seats sit the people who love the show the most."
That's interesting, yeah.
She said, and whenever you're doing on stage, if you're whispering, if you're singing, if you're, you know, soliloquizing, whatever you're doing, you must remember that it must reach those people. The intent of what you're doing must reach those people. You must be generous to reach your whole audience. So things like that were very valuable advice, of course.
You know, in your new book, you say, "I knew the names of the great Yiddish actors and plays of the turn of the century, but I knew none of the names of the baseball players or even the baseball teams in America."
That's absolutely true.
Were you mocked for that?
I was certainly considered different, but I was in my own sort of world. I mean, I guess the worst was there was a key game of kickball played in elementary school when I was out in extreme left field in a place where hopefully no ball ever would be kicked. And the night before, my grandmother had been doing some readings from the Oresteia, and I was really brooding on, you know, Clytemnestra's motivation, and after all, her daughter was killed, and this and that, and I was thinking all this, and suddenly a ball arrived and actually hit me. I had no idea it was coming. It hit me. I didn't catch it, and as a result, our team lost, and so I was roughed around a bit by the my fellow teammates for having been so inattentive. I think that was the worst moment.
Your parents moved to Los Angeles in the late 30s?
Correct.
Your father worked in the Hollywood industry, in the movie industry, as a scriptwriter, dialogue director. He changed his name from Tomaszewski to Thomas.
Right.
What was his reason for doing that? Was it an ethnic thing? I mean, everybody was changing their ethnic names to something more American.
No, it wasn't sounding. That. It was just that Boris and Bessie were so, so famous that every time my father would go to try and get some job, people would see the name Tomaszewski, and they'd say, "What? You're the son of Boris Tomaszewski?" And he said he could never sort of get past that. He wanted to do what he wanted to do on his own merits, and he didn't want to be confused with what it is my grandparents had done.
Did he ever regret changing his name? And do you ever regret that he changed it?
He certainly didn't. From time to time, I have. There was one point in my early career when things were moving very fast, and suddenly someone came to see me and said, in 20 minutes, you're going to be on national television, and you have to decide now if you want to keep your name as Thomas or change back to Tomaszewski. And I had 20 minutes to decide it, and I couldn't reach my parents, and I thought, gosh, this is the name they gave me out of respect for them. I'm not changing it. And it's terribly difficult for some people to grasp who are not English, that is, a name like Michael Tilson Thomas. But over the years, it's more and more becoming MTT, and gosh knows, here in San Francisco, it's really become MTT.
Mm-hmm. Michael Tilson Thomas is my guest. He's the new conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. He remains the principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra and artistic director of the New World Symphony. He also has a new book called Michael Tilson Thomas, Viva Voce. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. As a teenager, you participated in the premiere of works by Boulez, Stockhausen, Copland, Stravinsky. You worked with them directly, yes?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So did they give you a sense of what to expect if you made music into your life? You know, if you lived the life of a musician?
Well, they did. Many people did. I mean, also Copland and... And, of course, very much Piatigorsky,
mm-hmm.
and Ingolf Dahl, my incredible teacher, really was my central teacher in many ways. But I very early perceived that there were some people in the music business who had been playing music for their whole lives, who seemed to be ennobled and transfigured nearly by the process of making music, and others who seemed to be very unhappy and embittered by the experience of making music. And so I was trying from the very beginning to understand what was the difference between these people. Where did the choice lie between having a life in music that made you very, very happy or one that made you very frustrated?
What were you able to figure out?
Well, I decided way back then that it was important for musicians to kind of take a musical Hippocratic oath before they went into the profession.
And what is the oath?
That... you have to discover that it's just necessary for you to make music. I mean, to be a musician, you have to love music as much as eating or sleeping or dreaming or all those other ings. It has to be something that you just must do every day. And you can't be sure when you enter the profession of music where it may take you. It is uncertain. It depends a lot on being very well prepared and being in the right place at the right time. But I remember a moment when I was around 18 or 19 and I was walking on the USC campus where I was going to school, and I thought to myself, well, I know that I'm good enough. I know I'm good enough. I could be a university musician, and there are wonderful things happening at this music school. Of great quality and expression. And if I could do this, as long as I can make music, I'll be very happy. And if it turns out that I can make music in some larger arena, well, we'll see about that. But I know that it's music itself, which is this process, this dialogue with something in my spirit that I must pursue. And then I knew I was going into music with no other agenda. It was just the music itself that mattered. And it was those people for whom music truly mattered who were the ones that had wonderful lives as musicians.
Now, when you said you thought musicians should take a Hippocratic oath, I thought it would be, you know, first do no harm. And that would be something like never perform boring works.
Well, never perform with your heart not being in it. Never allow yourself to get to the point where it's a job. Always make sure that your spirit is focused so that communicating music to other people is a central priority for you.
I have a conducting question. I mean, a stick question. You studied, you know, classical stick technique. How much of that do you use now, and how much of your technique is based on what you've like learned and improvised over the years?
It's definitely a mixture of both. I think the easiest way for you to understand this is that there's a constant give and take process going on in the rehearsals and in the performance itself. So there are certain key moments where I have to really indicate the exact ictus of a certain moment in time to get around a particular corner. And then having done that, then what I want to do is sort of turn over the lead of the music to perhaps a solo oboe player, or perhaps the viola section, or maybe a brass chorale. All those different groups within the orchestra have their own reaction time. They all take breaths at a different speed. They all have a different way of interacting, and it's possible with my baton or with a little bit of body language or in using my eyes a lot, mostly in using my facial expression, my contact with the orchestra shapes all those things.
You were very close to Leonard Bernstein. Do you feel like you learned a lot about conducting technique from him?
Of course, I learned a lot from him by observing him, and mostly through the kind of colloquy concerning music that we had over many years. When I was studying pieces, I had the opportunity to, you know, to call him up and ask questions, and in the best kind of rabbinic style, almost always when I asked him a question, he would ask me a question back. And by this kind of dialogue of questions, he would help me to really find my own way of doing the music. And that was, of course, terrific. And I guess my conducting style has become a lot freer. It's a lot more economical now, maybe, than it was 10 years ago. But, you know, these things change. I can only say that now it feels to me in the repertoire that's really mine that as if I'm making the music happen in space, as if I'm touching the notes and actually molding them and shaping them in some kind of plastic way, you know, within time itself.
Let me ask you a question very, very bluntly. Do you worry about the classical music audience dying out in America? A lot of the classical music audience is older, and a lot of people worry that they're not being replaced by a new, younger classical music.
That is a very serious concern. Larger repertoire and larger audience are the two most important issues in classical music today, and these are both issues we are very actively addressing here in San Francisco.
How?
We already have a somewhat younger audience than in other parts of the country, and the sort of programming that I'm doing, and I'm happy to say it seems that when I do conduct, that more younger people do show up at the box office because they're interested in the kind of programming I present, which is a combination of music that is diverting, challenging, and reaffirming, and which exploits the possibilities of contrast and in a concert program and gives you maybe something more to think about than just the music. It causes you to think a little bit about, well, how did these different composers approach this experience of war, peace, reconciliation? It's also something I'm focusing on very much with my musicians at the New World Symphony, because I have this orchestra of young musicians I'm working with in Florida, and that orchestra not only is involved in developing their techniques as performers and making them consummate performers of Baroque music and contemporary music and the whole gamut of music, but also enabling them to speak and present themselves before an audience of both children and adults and kind of get them beyond the formality of classical music and into, you know, its central message.
So I must ask you, what do you think of people who, when they listen to classical music, start conducting? You know, when they're listening to a record, their arms start flapping about.
Good for them. if it moves them, they should enjoy it. That's what it's all about. Music is about being moved and about being touched, and that's what it should be.
You were on the road with James Brown once, right?
I was with him for a couple of days. I met him in Boston. He was doing a little, he was doing a show in a small jazz club, and I told him I was a great admirer of his, and he said, well, come on the road, you know, see how we do it, because I asked him how he got the band to be so tight, and this was the time when he was doing Sex Machine was his big hit. And I spent 3 or 4 days with him in Atlanta and Augusta and in Washington, D.C., watching from backstage just what he did, and it was a great thrill.
So did you learn anything you could apply?
Absolutely, because what I realized that he was focused on the exact duration of the perceivable present. In every particular piece, the stroke of the beat had a certain length. He wanted the trap drummer to be out in front and the hand drummer to be in the back and the bass player to be right in the center, and he had an exact idea of how wide in time that stroke of the chunk chunk would be, and he used it, and it was something very sophisticated and just the kind of thing that composers like Igor Stravinsky thought about a great deal.
So did it change the way you conducted at all, or the way you organized your beat?
It didn't changed the way I conducted so much, but it changed the way I could listen to music and imagine how the ictus, the exact moment of the attack in music, could be really artfully crafted to propel the music in different ways.
But you didn't have the orchestra do the beat on the one.
Well, I have the orchestra do whatever's necessary.
Oh, right. Well, Michael Tilson Thomas, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with the San Francisco Symphony.
Thank you so much.
Michael Tilson Thomas is the new music director of the San Francisco Symphony. His new book is Michael Tilson Thomas Viva Voce. On a recent CD, he pays tribute to his late friend Leonard Bernstein. This is Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in a performance of Bernstein's On the Town. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a support group for cops facing post-traumatic stress. We talk with the group's co-founder, Roger Mangum, a San Antonio police officer who shot and killed a man in self-defense in 1982. Also, the music of classical avant-gardist Luciano Berio. Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of Berio music performed by the late mezzo-soprano Kathy Berberian. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Avant-garde music has the bad rap of being unmelodic, grimly serious, and gloomily self-indulgent. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz says this isn't always the case. As evidence, he offers RCA Victor's reissue on CD of the late mezzo-soprano Kathy Berberian's memorable 1972 recording of Luciano Berio's Recital 1 for Kathy.
Luciano Berio was, and maybe still is, the most delightful composer of the classical avant-garde. He's especially admired for his brilliant musical exercises, which are more than exercises, for various solo instruments and solo voice. His favorite singer, even after they were divorced, was Kathy Berberian, who was surely one of the wittiest, most intelligent, and most versatile performers of the mid-century. In 1972, he wrote for her a half-hour-long cantata, really a performance piece before such a category became a familiar occurrence, called Recital 1 for Kathy, as if he knew even then that no one else but Berberian could ever capture all the special demands built into this piece. What we hear is a deconstructed vocal recital, with actual excerpts by practically every composer from Monteverdi and Purcell to Rossini and Bizet, from Mahler and Manuel de Falla to Schoenberg, to Berio himself. We get poetry quotations and snippets of the bell song from Lakmé, the fatal card song from Carmen, and the mad scene from Lucia, and an imitation of Marlene Dietrich in Blue Angel. It's like the musical counterpart of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland. It ends with the quiet prayer from a Requiem Mass, Libera me, please release me. Berberian goes, and we go with her, through the musical looking glass, or else she's having a nervous breakdown and we're trapped inside her head. And all this is not just funny or grotesque, but eerily moving.
Would you look at that fool? You should hear what they say about him. A fool of the gods. This is where we need an inner language, an emotion language. No, an intellectual language. A poetic language. The language of theoretical communication. Oh,
another delectable item on the CD is Berberian singing Berio's arrangements of 11 international folk songs. In I Wonder as I Wander, which is not really a folk song but an original song composed by folk singer John Jacob Niles, Berberian sounds just like one of those guitar-strumming, long-haired folkies of the 1960s.
As I wander out under the sky, how Jesus our Savior did comfort to die for poor ornery people like you and like I. I wander as I wander out under the sky. When Mary.
Then she also sounds like someone from Sicily or Sardinia, the Auvergne, Armenia, and Azerbaijan.
Не диш дом ик тередит, пусть не детство в муфа ходит, учту будит. Ай палам, сьора делим, шести снова, папалам.
The disc also includes the first release of three juicy Berio arrangements for Berberian of songs by Kurt Weill, two of them in Berberian's own colorful yet accurate English translations. It's been 12 years since she died, at the much too early age of 55. This album, long overdue for reissue, reminds us all over again how much we've lost.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Luciano Berio's Recital 1 for Kathy and Folk Songs and Berio's arrangements of three Kurt Weill songs on a new RCA Victor CD.
When your ship had come in from Burma, I was 16, my God, just a kid. And you asked me to come and stay with you. You'd take care of me good if I did. When I asked what you did for a living, and you swore just as I'm standing here, that your job had to do with the railroad, not with sailing, you made that clear. You talked a lie, Johnny, nothing was true, Johnny. You tricked me good, Johnny, from that first day. I hate you so, Johnny, how you stand and grin, Johnny. Take that pipe out of your mouth, you dog.
Coming up, what it's like when a police officer has to shoot in self-defense. This is Fresh Air. On TV and in the movies, cops often have to shoot people in the line of duty. But for real cops, shooting a suspect is a rare and sometimes traumatic experience. My guest Roger Mangum is a police officer in San Antonio, Texas. In 1982, while on patrol, he shot and killed a man in self-defense. A subsequent grand jury investigation found his use of deadly force was justified, but it was still hard for Mangum to accept that he'd taken someone's life. A couple of years ago, Mangum co-founded a support group for other officers dealing with the emotional after-effects of critical incidents. The group is called POST, an acronym for Police Officer Support Team. Since 1992, Mangum has been an instructor at the San Antonio Police Academy, where he runs tactical training classes. I asked him how often cops draw their guns.
Well, actually, very rarely, but there's two different characteristics of pulling the gun. Police officers can pull their gun quite often, but it may not necessarily be in a deadly force issue, and I'll give you an example. Maybe they got a call for a burglary in progress or a burglary alarm at a house or a building. Because there is the possibility of forced entry or burglary being committed, that officer may pull his gun to clear that building. Or if he's going to respond to a robbery alarm, and he's not sure if the robber has departed the scene or not. He may go into that situation with his gun out. So there's a difference between pulling your gun, going into an unknown situation, and then pulling your gun to having to shoot somebody. So that's a big difference.
You shot a man in 1982. Where were you patrolling on that day?
I was patrolling the midnight shift, and we call it the dog watch shift, but that's the 11 o'clock to 7 in the morning shift. And I'd only been out 2 years, so I was a two-year officer. 1982, I think it was November the 1st, and I was on routine patrol, and that's a misnomer in itself, the word routine patrol. That we seems like that that's when a lot of things happen to police officers. But I was checking out an abandoned house on the northwest side of town, and I noticed a suspicious person on the roof of this house. Actually, it was a rather large mansion. It was a three-story mansion, and he was on the roof, so I went to investigate, and I went up to the location where I'd last seen him on the roof, and he saw me and then ran on the fire escape down into the interior of the house, and we kind of played a cat-and-mouse game for 5 minutes or so when I was looking for him, and he was trying to elude me, and I could hear him running through the house, and he could probably hear me chasing him. And that went on for, I guess, 5 minutes or so, and then I didn't hear the noises anymore, so I went back out to my car, and that's when I heard a rustling in the bushes because there was a long hedgerow right there in front of this abandoned house. He came out of the bushes, and I guess he was about 30 feet away from me at that point. And I could tell he had something in his hands, but I really couldn't make it out at that distance and at that time of the night. The only thing I could see with my flashlight was that he was cupping his hand or holding his hand with some type of object.
What did you think might be in his hand?
Well, by the way he was holding it, I couldn't really tell at that time, but it appeared that he was holding his hand as if it was some type of edged weapon. I identified myself as a police officer. I didn't have my gun out at this point. It was still a suspicious person. And when I identified myself, he did not comply with my demands, and they were, let me see your hands, let me see what's in your hands, and stop right there and lay down on the ground. I was treating it as an unknown suspicious person. At that point, he started walking towards me, and again, I commanded him to, you know, stay where he was at. Police officer, let me see what's in your hands. He started getting closer, and I kind of felt my space being violated, so I started to step back as he would step forward. He got to within about 15 feet, and again, I was issuing him the commands, and when I put my flashlight on him, I could tell he had silver spray paint coming from the cracks of his mouth, because it kind of shined when the light hit him, and it had run down his neck. And then I saw he had a can, which I assumed had spray paint in it in one hand, but he still had this object cupped in the other hand, and I couldn't get a good look at it. But the closer he got, he was holding it as if someone would hold a knife by the handle. I started backing up some more, and he started coming towards me, at which point I guess he was less than 15 feet now, and he raised his arm up in the air as someone would holding a knife in a, you know, above the head thrust, and he yelled out, let out a scream, and then started charging me. And at this point, I pulled my gun, held it down to my side, but my first reaction was not to fire at that point. I was still trying to get away. I was doing the better part of valor, which is run. And I was retreating. I was backpedaling, but he was running faster, and he got to within 5 feet, and he started to lift back his arm like he was going to make this thrust with whatever it was he had in his hand. And that's when I raised my gun and fired, and he had got to within 5 feet when I finally pulled the trigger.
When you pulled the trigger, was that like a decision or a reflex?
It was a decision. It was a decision. When the shot went off, of course, anybody that's fired a gun will know that in a night like that, there's a tremendous muzzle flash. And he was close, so I figured I had hit him. By the time I got my night vision back and my vision cleared, he was still standing within that 5 feet, and he was smiling at me now.
Then what did you do?
Then I got the panic attack. I guess that's the best way to put it. From that point on, I could not fire my gun a second time because I had been conditioned, or I assumed that, you know, once I made that first shot, that the threat was going to go away and everything was going to be fine. But it really surprised me, after taking a hit in the chest with a .357, that the man was still standing. And not only that, he was smiling at me like, "You got me a good one that time, but, you know, here I come again." Fortunately for me, he held that that pose for just a couple of seconds, and then his knees buckled and he fell down to the ground, and at which point, you know, the situation was resolved.
Were you alone?
Yes.
No partner?
No, we don't ride partners here. By happenstance, there was a police officer like myself on patrol, but he was from Balcones Heights, which is a little town within our city limits. And he had happened to see my spotlight when I had first went up there, so he decided to go check it out. So luckily, he came upon the scene maybe just a few seconds before the shooting happened. But and he was there to finally help me apprehend the guy, but he wasn't directly involved in the actual assault and the shooting.
So what turned out was in this guy's hand?
It was a stick. It was a wooden stick that had been sharpened. He had taken the end of it and sharpened it to a point.
Could he have stabbed you with it?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when he had raised his arm back to, in a kind of like a downward motion, I assumed that he was coming at me with a knife. I knew that there was some type of, you know, he had some type of edge weapon in his hand. And then after I saw what it was, I still realized that, you know, had he hit me in the head with it, you know, he was going to make an instant lobotomy, you know, on me.
Now, you said that there was silver spray paint around his mouth.
Correct.
Did you find out what it was doing there, how it got there?
Well, it turned out that he had a history of you know, spray paint abuse. And he had just gotten to the point where that's...
So he was using it as an inhalant and getting high.
Correct.
Does that explain the smile on his face after you shot him?
I have no earthly idea what went through his mind or what he was thinking when he, you know, when he responded the way he did. Maybe he was impervious to pain. Maybe he didn't feel it. I don't know. But they determined that he was very intoxicated on that spray paint.
So you must have been stunned.
Correct.
This was like the first time you'd ever shot. This is the only time you've ever shot anybody?
Yes, first and only. Thank God.
So what went through your head right afterwards?
Fear. Fear of the unknown. Especially when I found out that, you know, this didn't turn out to be a knife, although it was, by its use, was a deadly weapon, which authorized me to use deadly force, but the fact that it wasn't what I knew it was. And then I thought to myself, well, my God, now they're going to say I shot a man with a stick. And then your mind starts going through all kind of things like, what's Internal Affairs going to think? And what's the chief going to think? And what's the public going to think? And what's the grand jury going to think? And it just goes on and on.
My guest is San Antonio police officer Roger Mangum. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is San Antonio police officer Roger Mangum, co-founder of a support group for police involved in critical incidents. Mangum shot and killed a suspect in self-defense in 1982. When did you realize that he was dead?
They told me about an hour and a half later. when I was down at the police station, you know, being interviewed by the detectives. Because, like I said, after I had shot him, it took him a second or two before he finally fell to the ground. And by that time, that other officer that had come over to, you know, to check on what I was doing, he went over and handcuffed the guy, and the guy was still struggling at that point on the ground, trying to get back up to come after me. So the other officer had to, you know, pretty much keep him pinned to the ground to get the handcuffs on him. So they, of course, EMS, that's our emergency medical service, they came right out and they were working on him. They put him in the ambulance, took him to the hospital, and I was transported downtown to talk to the follow-up units. And it was during that time, it was about an hour and a half later, when they finally told me that that he had died.
What was your reaction?
I started crying.
Were you surprised?
Surprised. I don't know if surprised is the word. I was upset and devastated, even though I did it to protect myself and save my own life. It was still a distasteful job that I did.
Was your shooting covered in the papers?
Yes.
How is it covered?
I still have a headline. Police officer slays man with stick.
And that bothers you because...
Well, I think, I guess it's just a play on words, you know, with me, but I guess that a police officer slays a man with stick, it to me, and this is just me personally, it makes me seem like there was this guy walking down the street with a stick in his hand, and I came up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. I mean, that's the impression that I got from the headline.
What about the article itself?
The article itself, surprisingly, was for the most part pretty fair, but I think it was just that attention-getting headline that that kind of had an uneasy, kind of set uneasy with me.
What did you find out about the man? Did he have a family? Did he have an interesting story?
No, not really. He had been arrested. They brought up his rap sheet after that, you know, to see what the background on this person. And he had been arrested 72 times for public intoxication and fighting in public. He'd been arrested several of those times for assault on police officers.
So what were the feelings that you had after you had to shoot someone in the line of duty? Did you feel guilty, angry, afraid?
Yeah.
What was the brew of feelings?
Well, I guess you could pretty much say that it was a Monday morning quarterbacking for me and other people also. Of course, you're always going to have people that Monday morning quarterback you. But there was many times immediately after that when I myself wondered, you know, did I do the right thing, or what if I wouldn't have been there, or what if I would have done this? You know, there's so many what ifs that come up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, second guessing the actions or my actions. I never felt a whole lot of anger or rage, although, you know, stress manifests itself in many ways. But mine was a little bit of depression, insomnia, sexual appetite wasn't quite like it was for a while. I don't know if guilt really came into it, because at that point, it came down to it was either him or I. So I don't know. I can't say that I was guilty about it, but I certainly wasn't, you know, pleased with having to do that.
God, I was reading an article in American Police Beat by another officer who it was actually about another officer who had shot someone in the line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And was dealing with all the emotional after effects of that. And he had said one of the things he found really disturbing was that a lot of people were coming up to him congratulating him for getting another, you know, getting rid of another one of those bad guys.
Correct.
Did you get any reaction like that? You know, congratulations for getting the human garbage off the street?
Yeah. There will always be people in general, and policemen specifically, that will say, hey, you know, you're a hero. You did really good, or good job. And I had a few of those slaps on the back and you know, like, you know, what's it like, or what, you know, how did you feel, and congratulations. And I think that's just ignorance talking. I really, I believe people that give you a pat on the back and say good job and call you a hero, usually you find that those are the people that haven't been there and they just don't know what it's like.
When you were describing what happened to you, you really knew how close the other person had come, and you said at some point that they got about 15 feet away from you, and you felt like at this point your personal space was being violated.
Right.
What are you taught as an officer where your space is being violated? How close can a person come before they're a threat to your life?
We don't really draw a line in the sand and give X amount of feet, but you know, you have to take the situation into consideration. Now, can this person, from whatever distance he's at, can he reach you and harm you before you can manage to get away, or, you know, take out an intermediate weapon or pull out your gun? So it's not so much the exact amount of distance. It's what that officer perceives, you know, as the threat. How big is this person? How quick can he get to you? What are his actions? Is he running? Is he just walking, or you know, stuff like that?
You're now teaching at the San Antonio Police Academy. You're teaching tactical training. Is there anything that you teach students there based on your own experiences of that night when you shot someone?
Yes. Never say it. It can't happen to me. You know, when we get young cadets and they've been pumped through all of this, you know, training, they feel like they're pretty much impervious to anything that can happen to them. And every now and then, I'll catch one of the cadets saying, "Well, if that situation comes up, you know, I'll do this and I'll do that because, you know, that can't happen to me." And that's one of the most fatal set of words that any police officer can make, and that is the you know, it can't happen to me because I'm academy trained. So I try to make each cadet realize that just because they're a police officer and they're putting on this vest and this gun and this badge, they are still vulnerable to, you know, any threat that can come up.
Roger Mangum is an instructor at the San Antonio Police Academy. He co-founded the police support group, POST. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Nancy Updike and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Writing Home by Alan Bennett, author of The Madness of King George. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.